is up, fellow Rockin' the Suburbs listeners? This is intern Sam here. Jim and Patrick have so graciously awarded me and my brother Josh a slot. If you listened to yesterday's episode, you heard us talk about Tony Comer and this really incredible kind of gospel synth album by Tony Comer and the Crosswinds called Visions, and how we discovered it and just sort of describing our appreciation for it and the mystery behind it. Well, that episode was recorded, I think, in the fall of 2021. And then as we got into the winter of 2021, Josh did some outreach and he was able to get in touch with the recording engineer that worked on the record at Dallas Sound Lab back in the day. His name is Rusty Smith, and we are so thankful that he was able to speak with us and tell us more about what it was like to work on this album. And he also shared with us a lot about his career. And this is something that we felt needed to be a two-part interview. So what you are going to hear is part one. Part one, you're going to hear a lot about Rusty's history and how he sort of got into the recording business, and then what led him from working at Dallas Sound Lab to working in Hollywood on television shows and movies. And it's really, really cool. So I hope you all enjoy it. This is part one of our interview with recording engineer Rusty Smith. Not mistaken words for I say me. Listen closely to my song and watch my eyes. There's not much time to spare but the heart of your ear. Walk out the long hair children living in the street. And the lucky not a Rusty Smith, thank you so much for joining us today on Rockin' the Suburbs. I want to start off a little bit here. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was into music as a kid. I started playing piano when I was 9 years old. I was in a band by the time I was 12. I was playing guitar in a band, and we were playing like The Ventures and Beach Boys and Little Latin Loopy Lou and stuff like that. And we were playing at parties in sixth grade, and the band would get paid $10. And there was five people in the band, and we'd get $2 a piece. And our parents would drive us to the gigs. And one of the members of the band was Mickey Mantle Jr., who was the son of Mickey Mantle. And we used to rehearse over at Mickey Mantle's house. And, you know, during the winter, during the off season, Mickey Mantle would come in and go, let's go outside and play football. So we'd play touch football with Mickey Mantle as a kid.
That is so awesome. Wow. So Mickey Mantle, man.
That's a little anecdote for you there. And then, you know, it progressed into bands that got, you know, better, and the musicianships got better, and ended up, you know, in my, by the time I'd graduated high school, I was in a band that we were drawing like 500 or 600 people a night, you know, in Dallas, Texas. And I was a bassist, you know, I played bass in that band. The band was called Felix. It was a cover band, but we really had a good show, and it was a good band. Everybody was very talented in the band. We did a lot of Allman Brothers, a lot of Sly and the Family Stone. You know, we did just anything that was popular on the radio. We were your classic, you know, cover band, but there was such great music out there. You know, we had Beatles medleys. It was a good thing. And of course, like every other band, it broke up because, you know, everybody got a little bit older and went their own way. And I ended up being in nightclub, you know, bands, you know, a lot of cover bands, some of the bands did original stuff. I was in a band with a guy named Rocky Athas called Lightning. And that was a very large, you know, very, you know, popular band, original band there in Dallas for a while. And then a few other bands. And ultimately I got tired of, you know, being in a bar band, traveling, you know, playing six nights a week. And so, cause I was traveling all over the country and I was never at home, and it wasn't very glamorous. And so I decided I wanted to become a recording engineer because I had done some recording over those years, and I was fascinated with it. And I, you know, on purpose, just specifically decided, okay, I don't want to play in a rock band, you know, and I'm going to go back to Dallas. I'm going to get in a lounge band and play in a hotel, you know, and stay in town. And I'm going to try and become a recording engineer in Dallas, because there were recording studios. And so that did pan out. It took about 5 years for it to occur. to where I was actually successful and working at Dallas Sound Lab. You know, in the interim, I was, you know, I had, it was a thing where some friends and I, you know, I was playing bass on in a small home studio, and with a drummer. We were the rhythm section, and there was these different songwriters that would come through. And so I did that for a couple of years. So I learned how to be a really good session bassist, or pretty good session bassist. And one of those guys and I, with another guy, we put together, we found a space, and we finished it out and made a studio and operated it for about a year. And I really learned a lot about, you know, how to record.
Wow.
And also learned that the recording business, owning a recording studio, was a horrible business model. And I decided that I was going to not ever own a recording studio, that I was going to just, you know, lease my talent out. And so I got a job as an assistant engineer at a place called Goodnight Audio, which Gordon Perry owned, and Keith, shucks, I can't remember his last name, but anyway, he was a producer out here in LA who, Keith Olson. He had a place called Goodnight LA, and he and Gordon were partners on that. And it was in the Sound City complex here in LA. So I, from that assistant engineer job, I was working with a great guy named Tommy Cassetta. He taught me, educated me how to, you know, where mics go, what kind of mics to use, and how to edit tape. And he was one of the two good engineers in Dallas, and I was his assistant for about 2 years. Ultimately went to Austin, Texas, did an album that petered out with at this place called Rough Cedar. It was owned by a guy named Russell Whitaker, who was the owner of Dallas Sound Lab. Mm-hmm. And he and I hit it off. He liked me. You know, I was, you know, apparently had good personal skills, he thought, and whether I was a good engineer or not, I don't know. But he, you know, he was like, you know, you're a hot engineer, and I'm going to build a studio in Dallas, and you're going to be my chief engineer. And I was like, sure, you know. Turns out he did. And so he hired me, and I, that's where, you know, I ran into Tony. And Tony, you know, so anyway, worked at Dallas Sound Lab for 4 years, moved to California, because I wanted to get into film and video. It went through after being here 3 years, I ended up working at Skywalker South.
Oh,
and,
nice.
And I was mixing The Simpsons and Northern Exposure. And then I moved over to Sony Pictures and worked there for 25 years. So it was just mixed a billion TV shows and movies. It's just, you know, one of these things where I'm working on a movie lot, you know, where they filmed The Three Stooges and The Wizard of Oz and all this other stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's the long and short of it. And there you go.
You mentioned that you grew up, you played bass. What music did you hear most of the time when you were growing up that kind of influenced you to get into playing that instrument and then getting in all these bands?
You know, it was Beatles, was huge. I mean, my brother was 10 years older than me. One of my brothers was, and he had a record player, and he had all these Sun records, you know. So mm-hmm. there was Carl Perkins and, you know, all these great records that he collected all these 45s. And of course I was 4 or 5 years old, and I would just sit home and spin his 45 records, you know, to entertain myself. And so that sunk in, you know, Blue Suede Shoes and Elvis Presley, you know, Jailhouse Rock. I thought was the coolest song ever. Then he had an album called the Peppermint Twist, you know, and I remember it back down from the five.
Well, they got a new dance and it goes like this. Yeah, the name of the dance is the Peppermint Twist.
peppermint twist. Such a peppermint twist. Yeah, round and round. Up and down. Round and round. Up and down. Round and round.
I was, man, this is so great, you know? And so I was, it was just sunk in that I dug music, you know? And then when I took a piano, I learned how to play. I was learning all classical piano, but when the Beatles came out, you know, literally, I'm your typical thing, you know, 64 February.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand when I say that something.
I'm watching them on Ed Sullivan and I'm like going, that's what I want to do right there, you know. And so I, you know, I was fascinated that Paul played left-handed, but I was still playing guitar. So I took up guitar, learned how to play guitar, learned how to kind of sing. And, you know, I already had a musical background with keyboards. So I understood chord structure and theory, you know, kind of, you know. And anyway, I knew what 1-4-5 was and the minor 2 and the minor 6. I knew these things and just from playing. And so, you know, Beatles, Beach Boys, pop radio, you know, Good Vibrations, all that kind of stuff. Just wanted to play in a band. And the only reason I ended up playing bass was because I got a phone call when I was 14. And there was a band that had a gig and they did, their bass player had quit. And they said, can you play bass? And I said, yes. I had never played a bass in my life.
Oh, wow.
So I knew what a bass did because we had an organ and I used to play the bass pedals, you know.
Oh, nice.
I literally knew it was just 1 and 5, you know, mm-hmm. because that's how you, what you'd, you'd learn, you know, playing these bass pedals on the organ. Because I could play, you know, the melody with my right hand, the chords with my left hand and play the bass with my left foot. So, yeah. I just went and played 1 and 5, and then I realized you could go 1-3-5-7. You know, I was doing that kind of stuff, you know, on the bass, and it worked. So they were like, and what I did, I didn't have a bass. I tuned my electric guitar down an octave, so the strings were just flapping.
Nice. you got to improvise.
And hey, we killed. That's all I'm saying.
Wow, that is so cool. That's really neat, man. And tell us more about how you're able to dip your toes into studio work, because you mentioned a little bit about Russell Whitaker reaching out to you and kind of getting you involved in this whole thing and building out this recording studio. I'm curious to hear more about that.
Okay, getting into the studio business was difficult because there was no real way to go to college and get a degree that didn't exist back then. Now you have recording schools and colleges actually have courses on it. I knew I wanted to do it. I didn't know if I could do it. I had no idea how to do it. So I bought a tape recorder, a 4-track tape recorder, and just started multi-tracking stuff at my house. It sounded absolutely awful. I had a lot of distortion on the recordings, you know, because I was over, the preamps were getting, you know, had too much signal hitting them, you know, and I didn't know what I was doing. But just slowly, I had the sound guy in the bands that I was in. We both had this fascination with how can we figure out how to record things and make it sound good. And so that went on for years while I was in these rock and roll bands. And we wrote terrible music and we recorded it. We were trying to be clever when we should have just tried to be simple. But we learned a lot about recording, and it just, one thing led to another. You know, the people in the circles of people in the bands that I knew, there were always these sound people that were enthusiastic about it. I just ended up, I guess when I realized I didn't want to be on the road anymore and I wanted to become a recording engineer, I knew it was a transition phase. You know, it was going to take years, and it was like, how am I going to do this? And it just, one thing led to another, you know, I'm going to keep doing this until I figure out how to do it. And to this day, I still feel like I'm trying to figure out how to do it.
That's very interesting. Yeah. You know, you feel like you're learning something new every day, no matter how old you get, there's always something popping up every single day that you're like, oh, wow, I wasn't aware of that.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. And I also want to talk to you a little bit about, because on your website, you list several artists that you have worked with in your time in the recording studio, you know, Phil Collins, David Burns, ZZ Top, Leon Russell. I mean, that must have been really exciting. Was there anything, was there a memorable studio session? Was there somebody that surprised you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. you got to understand that Las Colinas, wasn't like Dallas Sound Lab was the place where people went to make records, although records ultimately were made there. During the time period I worked there, it was mainly a place that people wrote jingles and industrial music for, you know, commercials and corporate events.
Really?
And so it was actually a lot, but you had the best players, you know, the session players were very good. And so you got to work with players who sounded good and who could play. And so whether you're recording something silly or not, you know, I mean, if you're recording a Cheetos commercial, at least the players were good, you know, and yeah. Their instruments sounded good. So it gave you, you learned how to get a great blend. And I mean, I could walk in, we'd have a downbeat at 9 o'clock with drums, bass, piano, guitar, you know, rhythm section. I'd walk in at 8:15 and I'd set up the mics. The cartage people would bring in the drums, et cetera. I'd set up the mics and I'd get the mics ready. The equipment would show up before the musicians because they had cartage, and I'd get the mics all set up and put in place. And I had a routine, you know, that I had fallen into, and I'd go into the control room, and then the musicians would come in, and within, you know, they'd come in around 8:30, and by 9 o'clock at downbeat, I would have all the sounds put together, you know, and, you know, going to multi-track, sounding great in the speakers in the control room, and I'd have two headphone mixes, separate headphone mixes.
Wow.
Put together, and I'd have that all done in 30 minutes.
Oh my goodness.
But I learned how to do that from being an assistant engineer, right? Mm-hmm. And I assisted a whole lot, and that's how most recording engineers that became successful learned. They learned from their peers, the guys who were 3 or 4 years older than them that had already knew what they were doing. And you were just constantly, what do you need? And looking at them, and why are they turning that knob? You know, and then after the session, you go, hey, you did this. Why'd you do that? You know, and that they tell you, and because they were busy doing what they did, and so you just had to stay out of the way and observe. And then at the end of the day, you know, if you were friendly enough with them and they liked you enough, you just could just go, why'd you? I don't understand why you put that mic over there. Why'd you do that instead of putting it over here? And he goes, well, because this was happening and that was happening. And that's why I did that, you know, or I don't know. I don't know why I did. I just wanted to try it. You know, sometimes they do that.
Wow. And were there any like musicians you remember that were definitely a little bit more picky or particular about certain things? I know people are different with how they are creatively.
Well, I guess you were referencing some of the iconic people I worked with. Now what I was trying to get at was those people, the iconic players were there because they were on tour and they were rehearsing with Shoko in a big soundstage.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't know that.
And so all the stuff I did with ZZ Top and Phil Collins and Robert Plant and these different people was because they happened to be working on that soundstage in a rehearsal, and Shoko was getting they were rehearsing the show.
Wow.
And so they would have ancillary stuff going on. Mm-hmm. You know, that they would, you know, they'd want to track something. And basically I would just get the gig because it would be at night. And because the two main recording engineers in town that made a better living than me, they were doing all the commercials. And so,
you know,
these guys would come in at 9 o'clock at night, and I'd work till 4 o'clock in the morning with them. And it was fun, you know, I mean, it was great. It was just it would be typically 1 or 2 days of working with them on something that you had to get done. They'd already have some work done on a multi-track, and they'd want to do some overdubs, or they'd want a quick mix on something, or they'd want to edit something, you know? And so I'd do that for them. And they were all very sweet. I mean, Leon Russell was just such a sweet guy. And Billy Gibbons, really, really smart guy, businessman, and really into porno, he was.
We'll be right back.
he always had these babes in his limo. You know, he was like really into women. He was a playa.
My God. That is hilarious.
But he was funny as a crutch. The guy was really great, you know. And so, you know, yeah, and but particular, I mean, Dave Mason, he was very particular. He came in and he you know, I had to work with I had to assist his engineer. Everything had to be just a certain way for him or he would just, you know, explode. He was a very temperamental guy. And I was like, man, yeah. I don't want to be around him. But I had to be around him. So I was around him for a week or so. But then again, I got to work with BB King. You know, he like did a Fritos commercial and he was the sweetest guy in the world.
That's awesome.
Most people were very, very, most successful people are very nice because they got a great life. Some of them are temperamental and they're hard to deal with. The most difficult musicians were the people that wanted to be successful and were not. And so the people who are successful are like, you know, they're just so happy, you know, because they've got this incredible gift of being able to write great songs that people love. And they get to perform them. And every time they turn around, whatever they need, they go, I sure wish I had this. And someone will go, here it is. You know, and they just hand it to them. You know? You want this? Here it is. You know, oh, I don't want to pick that up. I'll pick it up. Here it is.
Oh, wow.
You know? So they always had these people just, you know, swarming around them to take care of their needs.
And this is actually a great segue, too, because you work on these different commercials. And then immediately, well, I don't know about immediately, but after working on these different commercials with these different artists, you then kind of go into film and television. So tell us a little bit about that transition.
That transition involved, since we were doing commercials, the one thing that we could do at that studio at Dallas Sound Lab was we were able to lock a 24 track tape recorder to a 3/4 inch video machine in sync. We had synchronizers and we were the only studio that could do this in literally in Texas for a while. And, of course, now, you know, nobody thinks about that, you know, because everything's in sync on your computer. But we were doing it with a thing called a synchronizer, and there was time code on the multitrack, and there was time code, of course, on the 3/4. And so we were doing these commercials, and so we were scoring to the videotape, right? And so they could see the result immediately of what the music, how it went with the commercial. And so we do some voiceover. And so I'd mix the tune and the voiceover together against this. And then after a while, they're going, hey, do you have a sound effects library? And I go, yeah, we have some stuff. And can we put a sound effect here? It just grew to the point to where I was doing, we had two studios, three rooms. One was a voiceover room. One was the main room where we recorded the musicians. And then we built a third room, which was for doing post-production to picture. And I really gravitated to that work. It was interesting to me, and I wore all hats. You know, I'd record in the main room, mix it down, take it in the next room, put it on a multi-track, you know, sync it up against the picture, the commercial, whatever. Guy would come and do voiceover, then I'd edit a bunch of sound effects to it, then I'd mix the whole thing, and then we'd mix it to 1-inch video.
Oh wow, that's really cool.
And so, and then you do that in one day. You'd come out with a commercial in one day. And, you know, I come in at 8 a.m, I'd leave at 9 p.m, and it would be done. And so somebody came in with the worst movie ever produced by human beings. It was called Computer Beach Party.
This is fantastic. Did you put this together?
My dad helped a little. Hey, what's your sign?
Aries.
Love is heading your way. Your promise to someone else, you'll be sorry for it.
And it was this ridiculous movie that some shyster guy had convinced some guy to sink money into. And I posted that movie, and I was overwhelmed. I did not know how to do it correctly, and it showed up. You know, I mean, I was like, I was used to making these small little things. Well, this thing was, you know, it was 90 some odd minutes of whatever, and it entailed a lot. And I realized, wow, I don't know how to do this, and I'd love to know. And I went and saw a Kevin Costner movie, one of his first movies where he was a cowboy, and I can't think of, I always can never remember the names of iconic things. But anyway, I went and saw this movie. When I walked out, I was with my wife at the time, and I said, that's what I want to do. I want to mix movies, you know, because the sound of it was in Dolby, and I'm blown away with it. And so I was gravitating in that direction. A guy named Roger Bellon, who was a composer on Falcon Crest, mm-hmm. Which is an old, you know, dramatic, stupid TV show.
Yeah, yeah.
He shows up in Dallas. I do some session work with him over 4 days, and he's this French guy, and he thought I was just, you are brilliant, you know, and I love what you do, you know, and I'm like, oh, great, you know, and he was like, you should move to Los Angeles. You will be fantastic there. And I'm like going, you think? And he goes, oh, of course, you know. And so he goes, you can stay at my house. I live in the Hollywood Hills. It is marvelous, you know. And so I said, okay.
Nice.
So I go to Hollywood and hang out with this guy for a week. And I took a bunch of audio and video demo tapes with me. And I'd lined up interviews with every, you know, major facility in Hollywood. And I went in and just, you know, just cause I was the chief engineer at Dallas Sound Lab was my title, and they, oh, sure, you can come in and talk to you. And, so one thing led to another, and I ended up getting a job offer from one of those facilities, which was a small facility in Burbank.
Mm-hmm.
And, so anyway, but Roger was like, when he was telling me I should move to, Los Angeles, I went home one night and I looked at my wife and I said, I think we're going to move to Los Angeles. And she goes, I like LA Law.
Okay, that was part one of our interview with Rusty Smith. Shout out to Josh for reaching out and pitching this idea. He was really gracious with his time. We talked to him, I think, for over an hour. So you're going to hear other bits and pieces of our discussion tomorrow. He will chat with us more about working as a recording engineer and specifically working as a recording engineer on the album Visions, the Tony Comer and Crosswinds record. So you don't want to miss that. And he'll also share with us what it was like to win his first Emmy. So lots of great stuff for tomorrow. Make sure to follow us on the social networks at Suburbs Pod. That's on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can follow me on Twitter at Slisker, S-L-I-S-K-E-R. If you want, you can email the podcast rock@suburbspod.com, or you can call 612-440-1984. All right. Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll catch you tomorrow.
And had this great, I was just, man, this is so great, you know.